This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aisha Imam, is a women's rights activist in Nigeria. To understand what she's up against, consider the upheaval that forced out the Miss World pageant, which had been scheduled to be held in Nigeria this weekend. Muslims protested against the pageant, saying it was indecent and immoral. Rioting broke out after a fashion journalist wrote that the Prophet Muhammad probably would have chosen a wife from among the contestants. Protesters burned down her newspaper's office, and the deputy governor of Zamfara State, where the pageant was supposed to be held, issued a fatwa calling for the journalist's death. Zamfara was the first state in Nigeria to adopt a conservative Islamic criminal legal system, or Sharia, after the military government was replaced by a civilian one in 1999. Aisha Imam has campaigned against the adaptation of this law. She's the executive director of the group Baobab for Women's Human Rights. On Monday, she received the John Humphrey Freedom Award from the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development in Montreal. I asked her if she expected problems when the Miss World pageant was initially planned for Nigeria.
I knew there was likely to be trouble because it's both conservative Muslims and conservative Christians are uncomfortable with the idea of beauty pageants in particular. But the likelihood that it was actually going to escalate into the type of conflict and injuries and deaths that has happened, that I think most people didn't foresee.
I'd like your reaction to the sentence the journalist wrote in Nigeria that was responded to with the fatwa. And she wrote about the Miss World pageant, "What would Muhammad think? In all honesty, he probably would have chosen a wife from one of them, from one of the contestants." What was your reaction when you heard that line?
I think it was fairly foolish and somewhat irresponsible to have printed it in the climate of tenseness in Nigeria right now. It's not been unusual for there to be a good deal of conflict, including violence. Nonetheless, that does not excuse the burning down of this day office, nor the fights and conflicts, the burning of mosques or churches, and especially not the deaths and injuries. And it certainly doesn't excuse the fatwa. One thing I'd like to make clear, though, is that a fatwa is simply a legal opinion. Nobody is obliged to follow it. And anybody can have a fatwa. It depends on who you ask. Anybody can give you a fatwa depending on what their particular opinion is. I don't think that the deputy governor of Zamfara State is particularly religiously or morally qualified to be giving fatwas. But secondly, I think that for any state government to endorse something that is calling for people to kill somebody else without due to process of law is simply an incitement to murder and is worse than irresponsible.
Now, the state that has endorsed the fatwa, Zamfara State, is one of 12 states within Nigeria that has taken on this more conservative form of Islamic law. It was actually the first state to adapt this form of law. What exactly has it adapted?
Well, actually, what has happened in Nigeria is that since independence, what we've had is that Muslim laws have been largely confined to personal laws, so marriage, divorce, inheritance, child custody and guardianship, except as encapsulated in the penal code, which was adopted around independence. Muslim laws was not reflected in criminal legislation. And in the penal code, it was it had an influence, but it was not directly what is now being passed as Sharia. What has happened is that in the Sharia acts that states have passed, beginning, as you said, with Zamfara, they've picked up on particularly conservative variations and taken those even without the safeguards that existed in 13th and 14th century legislation. So it's not that they've reverted to a strict form of Muslim laws. What they've actually done is taken up a truncated and twisted version of it. For instance, a lot of the punishments that they give, which they claim come from the Quran, stoning, for example, is nowhere mentioned in the Quran. So the claim that they are picking up laws that are divinely given is not at all true.
12 out of the 19 states of northern Nigeria, and most of this area is Muslim, now practice Sharia, the Islamic law. This shift to Islamic law happened in 1999, after the end of military rule with the start of a civilian government. Were you surprised by that? Did you think that at the end of military rule that things would loosen up a little bit as opposed to getting more conservative and more anti-woman?
The thing that's clear to those of us who work on women rights issues is that it's not easy to make an automatic assumption that civilian rule means more women's rights and military rule doesn't. But what I do want to comment on is the reason why the adoption of Sharia law has proved to be surprisingly popular at much of the grassroots level. And it's not for the reasons that I think that most people outside of Nigeria think. It's less about religious identity and more about aspirations for personal security, law and order, anti-corruption and social justice. One of the things that's very often said is that where there are strict punishments, and I understand that there are many states in the US who where this is believed also, but that where there are strict punishments, there will be an increase in law and order. And in Nigeria, many people have suffered from a breakdown in law and order, the inability to rely on the police to be able to carry out policing duties, the increase in armed robbery that used to be more or less confined to the relatively wealthy, but is now happening also in very poor neighborhoods. And so that was one hope, that out of Sharia or strict criminal legislation and harsh punishments would come law and order and an increase in personal security for ordinary people. But increasingly, the implementation of it is seeing that rather than focusing on security, on such issues as embezzlement at the top ends of theft, that it's issues of morality and only poor people who are being picked up and punished for it. And there is increasing, I think, dissatisfaction and disillusionment with it. And I think people are beginning to see past the facade to the fact that it was simply a political ploy.
Are the new Islamic laws that have been instituted in states through northern Nigeria particularly harsh for women?
In principle, they're not particularly harsh for women. In principle, they're actually absolutely gender neutral. There are exactly the same punishments for women as for men. But clearly, in the implementation, there has been a great deal of discrimination. For instance, more women are being charged with zina or immorality offences than are men. And obviously, it takes two to engage in any immoral act, if it is immoral. Secondly, when men are charged, they have often been offered a chance to retract confessions. And technically, if you retract a confession and there isn't the evidence of four witnesses, then you cannot be charged with it. So men are being offered the chance to retract confessions. Women are not. They're not even informed of the provision that it's possible. Thirdly, often for crimes like rape, men are being charged under the previous penal code as opposed to the new Sharia legislation, which has a lesser punishment. Whereas allegedly for consensual sex outside of marriage, women are being charged with offences for which the ultimate punishment is supposed to be stoning or whipping. And men, for rape, are being charged under an act which gives lesser offences. So that's very, very clear gender discrimination in the way it's being implemented.
Tell us about one of the cases that you took on, working on behalf of a woman who was going to be subjected to a very harsh punishment.
Well, there are a number. The first case was that of Bria Magazu, she was then 13 years old, who got pregnant and was sentenced to whipping. In the law as it stands, whipping is for people who are not married, women who are not married, and stoning is for people who are or who ever have been married. And so she was 13, she was convicted and sentenced to whipping. When we intervened, the judges in the case said that she would not be whipped until after she had finished breastfeeding, which is also a standard provision in Muslim laws, which gave us time to start filing an appeal. But what happened was two things. One, the governor, the executive arm of Zamfara State, started intervening in the judicial process, which is itself illegal, and the court officials were directed not to accept the appeal I mean, physically, they were refusing the pieces of paper for the application of the appeal. But secondly, in the face of both national and international protests, the governor of Zamfara State was proudly boasting about resisting these Westerners and these infidels and apostates, which is what he calls those of us who are Muslim and who oppose what he's doing. And had the sentence brought forward without notice, she was informed the night before, and then had her whipped. So that one of the things that is very clear to us is that international protest does need to be very carefully managed if it's not to be counterproductive.
When you said that she was whipped, this was a particularly harsh whipping too. I think it was like 100 strokes of the cane. Do I have that right?
It is 100 strokes of the cane, but there are also regulations about having to hold a book, usually the Quran, between your forearm and the side of your chest, so that in fact only the lower part of your arm, the whipper's arm, can be moved. So each blow in itself is not very hard, but 100 blows is a lot. And not only that, it's the public humiliation.
It sounds like the law has not only become more restrictive and the penalties more severe. It sounds like there are men in Nigeria who now feel justified in attacking women on the streets when the men think that the women are displaying a loose morality.
That's true. And I think that there is a general feeling that men now have the right to stop women wherever they see them if they think they're not dressing properly or they're behaving in an immoral way. I think, to be accurate, one thing that we shouldn't forget is that actually a number of men have also been charged under these acts and have also been whipped, okay, although none of them have been sentenced to stoning.
Mm-hmm.
But what is clear is that except in some states, like again Kano, where the state government has discussed with members of the ulama, the Muslim clergy, and made public announcements on the radio, on the television, in the newspapers, that people taking the law into their own hands will not be allowed to do so. In Zamfara, for example, they have very clearly given not just tacit but formal approval to vigilante groups of young men going around and imposing their version of what life should be like on everybody else. So I think clearly there is a severe problem there.
My guest is Nigerian women's rights activist Aisha Imam. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Aisha Imam. She's just won a human rights award, the John Humphrey Freedom Award, for her human rights work on behalf of women. She's the founding director of Baobab for Women's Human Rights, which is a group in Nigeria where she lives. Now, you're a Muslim, yes?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how you were taught growing up to think about adultery or, you know, pregnancy out of wedlock and what the consequences might be? I mean, what the sense of morality was in your house? I'm assuming that there wasn't this sense of ultra harsh penalties.
Well, it would be true to say of all of Nigeria, I think, that while it's never been approved, it has never been thought that any group had the right to make a direct punishment. Mm-hmm. You know, so there might be some social ostracism. But certainly, until 1999, it was not a legal offense.
Pregnancy out of wedlock wasn't a legal problem. Adultery wasn't a legal offense either?
No, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It might be, you know, a social solecism. But it was not a criminal offense.
Right.
There was nothing that the courts would do about that. It was just, you know, it was just not thought of. Certainly during the years that I was growing up.
Did you grow up with a knowledge of women's rights, or is that something that you learned later on in life?
I always grew up with it. It was a knowledge, I think, generally of rights as a whole. I think many children are born with a sense of this is fair or this isn't fair. And the pity is that somehow along the line their socialization trains that innate sense of fairness for everybody out of them. And I suppose I was lucky in that my parents and my upbringing encouraged that sense of justice. The fact that I work on women's human rights is because there is a particular need there. But I do see women's human rights as part of a panoply of human rights for everybody. And yes, always. Like I can remember since in secondary school, I was 12 or 13, we started a club for, I have to say it, good eating and good works.
What was that about?
Well, I was in boarding school and we were not enamored of the food. So the good eating was about, you know, having treats. But the good works were about doing things that would help other people. So
you got an early start there. No, because of the like ultra conservative strain within the Islamic world now, many people think that Islam must be incompatible with women's rights and with certain larger human rights, and with democracy. And I'm wondering, from your Islamic upbringing and your knowledge now of what's happening in certain Islamic states within Nigeria, do you think that Islam is incompatible with women's rights?
No. The issue is not what Islam is or isn't. It's the use that some Muslims make of Islam within Muslim discourses. And I make a distinction between Islam, the religion, and Muslim, what people who believe in the religion do or don't do while ascribing it to the religion. And it's very clear that there are some, obviously, very conservative ideas about women's rights that are held by some Muslim. But there are also some very, very progressive ideas about women's rights that are held by other Muslims. A family friend, an uncle of mine, in the 1950s wrote a series of articles on women's rights in Islam in which he argued that women had the right to vote, the right to go to school, the right to work outside of the house, the right not to be secluded. That was the 1950s in Nigeria. So what we're doing is not new. In fact, if you look at Muslim history, a lot of the incidences that are referred to even as sunnah, that is to say the traditions of the life of the Prophet, are women going to the Prophet and saying, so-and-so says I can't do this, is that so? And the Prophet saying, of course not, of course you can do it. For example, in one case, a young woman came to the Prophet and said, my father wants to marry me to my cousin. Does he have the right to do this? And the Prophet said, no, he doesn't. And so the young woman says, okay, I don't mind being married to him, but I just wanted to be clear that I had the choice. You know, that was the Prophet directly. Now, how that gets transmuted into saying that in Maliki Sharia law, fathers have the right of ijbar, which is the right to compel their young daughters in marriage, is not a total mystery, but it's clearly inconsistent with both what's actually in the Quran and with what the traditions of the Prophet are themselves.
We've been talking about Islam in Nigeria. Nigeria has a large Christian population. Is there the same kind of ultra-conservative strain or extremist strain now in Christianity in Nigeria as there is in Islam?
Yes, to some extent. The one thing that you might know is, or may not know, is that in fact Kaduna, which is where most of this fighting is going on, is about 50% Muslim and 50% Christian. So it's not a Muslim state. The issue is not just that they're conservatives, it's that they're what I call essentialist identity politics, or what other people have referred to as fundamentalists, who are not just saying we have these views, but who are saying that we are willing to impose these views by force on other people. So yes, there are both Muslims and Christians who do that. The problem is that in the Muslim communities, there are people who are manipulating that for political reasons who are in positions of state power.
You went to college in England.
And also in Nigeria.
And in Nigeria, okay. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how the years you spent in England affected your politics, your sense of religion, or your sense of women's rights.
When I was an undergraduate in England, I remember feeling that I was expected to be two separate people in my politics. I could join women's groups that were largely white and middle class, and I could join groups around black people's rights, which were largely working class but very male-dominated, or I could join groups for social justice, which were mostly white, male, and middle class, but there was nowhere that I could be all facets of me together, if you like. And so what I found when I came to Nigeria was that when I went back to Nigeria after I finished my first degree, that was a place where, in fact, that I could insist on being interested in social justice issues, interested in poverty issues, and interested in women's rights issues. And that was the point at which we formed this group that's called Women in Nigeria, which still exists. This was the early 80s, which argued that women's rights issues and social justice issues in general had to be tackled simultaneously, rather than what we were hearing usually, which is, let's deal with the general problems first and then we'll get to the women.
Right. Have there been attacks against you or your group because of your work on behalf of women's human rights?
So far, none of us, thankfully, have been physically attacked, but we have been threatened, and me in particular. I take all the precautions that I can, but at the same time, if we don't speak up, if we don't do the best, then we've already lost the battle.
Aisha Imam is the executive director of the Nigerian group Baobab for Women's Human Rights. On Monday, she received the John Humphrey Freedom Award from the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development in Montreal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.